Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you Sword and Sandal Cinema, but first, a legend of Hercules set in mythic Atlantis. Heracles, en route to Greece after fighting at Parthians, finds himself shipwrecked. Verna, a desert princess, rescues then abandons him. He finds her ring while following her trail. Wandering the sandy waste, he assists a small band of warriors, besieged by a larger band of mounted bandits dressed in blue robes. Triumphant, the warriors escort Heracles to their chieftain, Care, who promptly challenges him to a feat of strength. He is then informed that the bandits work for Assur, Verna's father. Leaving their company, he locates Verna, returns her ring, and learns that Assur thinks that it is Care who leads the raiders. Assur and Care then join forces with Heracles to solve the mystery, and Verna is kidnapped by the Blue Robes. They are heralded by a strange, unearthly noise and have rigid golden hands. Heracles and Care follow their tracks into the desert. Devilish tricks and traps delay them. The tracks lead west past the mountains of the Dead Ones into the City of the Phantoms, a necropolis of tombs and ruins cursed by Set. While exploring, our heroes discover Verna's Veil. Serpentine Mesoamerican sigils with ruby red eye grace the wall of one of the structures, where they almost succumb to poison gas. Escaping into the desert, they make their way toward a tower decorated by the same golden symbol. Falling through a trapdoor, they are captured by Amazons and taken to the laboratory of Vermeer, an eccentric mad scientist. Breaking free from the women warriors, they are set upon by Vermeer's golden phantoms. They are easily subdued and taken to the queen, who is revealed to be Verna. She orders them imprisoned. And there I must pause until the second half of the show with a conclusion to Conqueror of Atlantis, also known as Kingdom in the Sand. And now, without further ado, the one, the only, Michael DeLucci. Greetings and welcome, brother. How are you?
To be with you tonight. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here as well, and I'm really looking forward to hearing your thoughts.
Well, as usually the case, I'd like to open up with some reflections, if I can.
Of course.
About the Sword and Sandal era, thinking about it over the week, the myths are not an attempt to control the nature of civilizations, but rather to bring them in accord with it. And so the Sword and Sandal decade was a time when the gods touched the earth, and that's what I like to call it. When it comes to the Sword and Sandal phenomenon, I like to focus my segments upon the spiritual and psychological transformation that have taken place within us. A focus and determination, a universal grasp of right and wrong, a spirit of to correct injustice. This is what was brought to us during the Sword and Sandal era. And any religious doctrine claims superiority to the messages Sword and Sandal heroes have brought to us. I would ask all to consider that revelation. And once again, as we do every month, I try to look at the Sword and Sandal, not only for some of the wonderful films that came out of that era, but for the psychological, sociological, and spiritual impact that they have had upon our society. So I always like to reflect on that, and I'm glad and grateful that I've had the opportunity to do so.
And I'm glad that you do so. I think about such things all the time as well, and I'm glad that you're verbalizing them.
What I'd also like to do, and I try to do this every segment, is get an update from you on your training experience and how things are going with some of your challenges, if you will.
Well, basically, as you know, I hurt my back, my lower spine, mm-hmm. and I went to the emergency room. And they diagnosed me with arthritis of the spine. I had a couple of bulging discs. I have stenosis, and I also have bone spurs. So it's a lot to focus on. I'm waiting for an appointment to see a physical therapist. What I've been doing in the interim is I've been going to YouTube and looking at physical therapy tapes on the different ailments I have in my back and recommendations on what to do to alleviate or heal them. And I've been doing the exercises that everyone agrees are useful, because as you know, there's a lot of contention in any field and information that's contradictory. So if there's contradiction,
absolutely,
like some physical therapists like an exercise and other physical therapists say, don't do that exercise, the worst thing you could do, I just won't do the exercise, because there are plenty of exercises that everyone agrees are beneficial. So I've been doing the exercises daily. Thank you for recommending low back tracks.
Has it been helping you at all? Do you feel as though it's been...
I've been using it every day, and it's made a difference. It seems to space the vertebra on the spine a little bit and alleviate some of the pain. I could feel the pinch with my fingers if I run them across near my spine on my right side. But since we last talked about this, the problems with my leg have gone away. And I'm not taking any pain relievers or putting any hot cold pads on it or ice or anything. Although I'm not healed yet, I'm doing a great deal better. So thank you for asking, and thank you for recommending the low back tracks and your own experiences.
Yes, well, I know that it's been I don't want to overemphasize, but I can honestly say that it's been a minor miracle for me. When I do it, I'll press it up probably against just below the knee, just above the knee, rather. And I can actually feel the pulling of the tendons and ligaments, mostly on the right side, my right leg. So I could feel them stretching. So I'm glad that I can experience that sensation, because that's how I'm aware that it's doing the job. And so, you know, I like to apply various degrees of pressure, and I use it at different parts, again, just above the knee. So I'm very confident that that's my main weapon. I have most of the issues that you're suffering from, I also have with my back, along with curvature of the lower spine. Do you have scoliosis?
Not that I was diagnosed with, but who knows? I haven't had official physical therapy yet, so I don't know what else they're going to find. But I'm trying to address the things I know about as best I can. I've also made changes to my diet and my exercise routine. I'm finally to the point where I'm doing weights again. They're not heavy weights, but they're still weights, and I'm doing current weights like every other day.
Well, I think that, you know, I have found that working with the bands and lighter weights, 10, 15 pounds actually, I can get the higher reps, and of course you're still stimulating the muscle. So I come away with a workout like that feeling somewhat gratified that I've accomplished something. But I know exactly what you mean. Part of the challenge of being a warrior is, you know, working around some of these things and finding innovative ways to get our training in anyway. So I thank you for sharing those that experience up to this point. Have you been using the X? Is it the X3? Or what am I referring to? It was a tool that you were using.
Yeah, the X3 I was using. I took a break for the X3 because that would put some of the exercises would put a lot of strain on my lower back. So along with the physical therapy exercises and using the low back tracks, I'm really not putting that much additional pressure on the area. I tried to one day. It started flaming up. So I backslid after that in my treatment for a couple of days. So now I'm respecting its need to heal, and I'm kind of working around it with the heavier weights or the stronger bands. I'm using bands also, but they're not the heavy duty bands. They're kind of like medium, I guess you call them, in doing my exercise. And for people who are wondering why we're talking about this on a Sword and Sandal Cinema show, because we've touched upon the topic many times that the sword and sandal cinema phenomenon, rather than just inspiring certain people and having them look at the world in a heroic way and to lead heroic lives, also drove the sport of bodybuilding. And it was the first time that it was popularized and entered the public consciousness as something good. Unfortunately, bodybuilding was like with porn, you know, it was a disreputable type of topic until the sword and sandals came out. And then it became acceptable and fashionable to work out with weights. And that's what started the whole bodybuilding phenomenon.
Absolutely. It was an underground sport, to say the least. Of course, then it wasn't even considered a sport. I remember back in the late 50s, as an example, there may have been something wrong with you if you were attracted to weight training. I don't know if you remember those fun. There was a real stigma. There was a stigma there. And I remember my physical fitness teacher in pre-high school told everyone, don't lift weights. It'll only make you muscle bound. Don't lift weights. Of course, at the same time, while we were being advised that here in the States, over in the Soviet Union, that was one of the mainstays in terms of their training for their athletes in almost every sport. And of course, they excelled for decades in powerlifting, breaking all kinds of weightlifting records. But that was the stigma, especially here in the States. I would imagine mostly overseas too. I don't know. I can't really speak to that. But I'm glad you pointed that out because, talking about training, physical fitness, overall physical development is very much part of the sword and sandal phenomenon. So I think we're right in line when we talk about these things. So that's why, as far as I like to address my segment, to sharing training experiences with you and hearing what your latest challenges or advancements are in this area. I think it's very educational, vitally important, and certainly connected with the sword and sandal consciousness.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And I'm really looking forward to what you're going to share about Ed Fury as well.
Well, Ed Fury was, I enjoyed all of Ed Fury's films. And the one I would like to address tonight, which is probably my favorite, is Ursus in the Valley of the Lions. That unquestionably was probably my favorite film of his. It was made in 1962, and although it was the fourth film in the Ursus series, it was the first to provide Ursus with an origin storyline, how he was raised by a lioness. And I had forgotten just what a great impact this film had on me until I watched it again earlier today. Alberto Lupo also appears in this film as the villain Ajax. I have to stop and just make a quick comment on him.
Sure.
He was one of my favorite foreign film actors. Alberto Lupo, I know, was in several sword and sandal films, and I loved him the most in a horror flick called Adam Age Vampire. I'm sure Brian from Brian Cinema has probably already covered this film. I think he was an exceptional actor. And one of my favorite foreign film actors, if you will, and at some future date, I'd really like to delve into his career. Alberto Lupo put all of his spirit in every role that he took on. So at some point, I just wanted to honor him for a moment. And hopefully in the future to discuss his career. But he plays the villain in this, the villain Ajax. The evil Ajax sends his armies to attack a neighboring kingdom. And during the battle, the besieged king, Anuus, orders one of his subjects, his son Ursus, to a place of safety outside the city after putting a medallion around his neck. Ajax kills the king and claims the throne, but the infant prince is smuggled to safety. Later, the child Ursus is abandoned alone in a hidden valley, where he is raised by a pride of lions who mistake him for one of their cubs. Ursus grows to manhood with the lions as his family, and I found this absolutely fascinating when I was much younger and first saw this film for the first time. One day, a caravan of slave girls breaks down near the cave by Ursus, and after repairing the wagon, he takes Anya, one of the slave girls, as his payment. The evil King Ajax is still alive and sitting on the throne once held by Ursus's father. He fears Ursus will come seeking revenge and sends soldiers to arrest Ursus. The soldiers kill all but one of the lions with poison meat. And I remember how this affected me at the time. I felt so bad watching this part of the film. While at the same time kidnapping Anya and using her as a hostage to force Ursus to give up, Simba, the only lion remaining alive, follows the chained Ursus to Ajax City, trying to remain close to Ursus. At the climax of the film, Ursus manages to free himself from the king's dungeon, makes his way to the grand arena, and physically holds back elephants, saving condemned citizens from death. Ajax tries to escape, only to be killed by Simba, the last remaining lion. I hesitate to say this, but that was a thrilling part of the film for me, to see the lion become to see the lion become the hero. Ursus reclaims his father's throne with Anya at his side. Reflecting on the film, I love the cinematography. Again, as a child, I was profoundly affected by the death of all of the lions. You know, you see them all lying there, being killed by the poison. I mean, that really had an effect on me. But I love the ending where Simba ultimately became the hero. The cinematography was great. Ed Fury had an acting style all his own. He was very expressive in his face. If you've seen any of his films, I'm sure you had.
Yes.
His expressions were very, very bold. Did you notice that in his acting? He was very, very expressive. You could read everything in his countenance, if you will.
Yes, when I had conversations with Brian in some of the shows, we always talk about how every person who played Hercules has or Ursus or Atlas, or they're pretty interchangeable at one point, brings something to the role. Like Alan Steele brings a devil may care type of attitude, and he looks so thrilled to be in the movie. And Rick Park brings like a bored, I'm so powerful that I don't have to pay attention, or you know, I can fall asleep, you know. And he did. He often took naps during his adventures. And Steve Reeves was very solemn and rigid. And, you know, so every one of them brought something special to the role. And Ed Fury brought his own magic to the screen as well.
He did. In fact, some reviewers say he was, some of his expressions at all were, he brought a flair of comedy to some of his expressions and the way he portrayed his character. And I could see that. Rewatching the film today, I could see that. There was like almost like a parody somewhat in his nature and the way he expressed the overall, his own overall vision of the character he was playing, which was basically Ursus, to my knowledge. I think that was his main sword and sandal character, if you will. But reviewing his life, he passed away on February 24th at the age of 94. That was this year. He was famed for his physique and his modeling. He was modeling as well as a physique star. And he was born in 1928 in Long Island, a fixture of the Muscle Beach bodybuilding scene from the 1940s after moving from New York to the West Coast. He routinely modeled for photographers, showing off his natural muscles and Hollywood good looks. He was a very nice-looking man. Fury had uncredited parts in films such as Because of Him, Abbott and Costello Go to Mars, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and Bus Stop. And he made use of all of his physical attributes in those films. He landed a larger role in The Wild Women of Wongo. I haven't seen that yet. I'll have to go back.
It's an old-time film, very campy. The language that the Wild Women of Wongo are speaking is Greek. I remember the first time I saw it, and people were saying, oh, they're talking gibberish. And I was saying, no, they're talking Greek. I could follow all their conversations.
Really?
That's
interesting. I'll have to see this film. Did he have the starring role in this, or?
It's been a very long while since I've seen that. I'd say I haven't seen that since maybe the early 80s, the last time I saw the Wild One long ago. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to have to review that. I've heard of it so many times, but it's one of the few B films that I have not seen. So I'll have to check that out. In the 60s, he relocated to Europe to capitalize on the sword and sandal craze. This was after Wild Women of Wongo. Dury's best-known character was Ursus. He also played Ursus in Valley of the Lions and Ursus in the Land of Fire. I saw that one. I'm going to have to review that once again. It's been many, many years since I've seen the film. Fury continued to make guest appearances, showing up on shows such as Gilligan's Island, Star Trek, I don't remember that, Mission Impossible, and Columbo. I'll have to recheck that as well.
Wow.
Fury avoided the limelight in later years, but was honored in 2001 at Venice Beach alongside fellow bodybuilders Peter Lucas, Reg Lewis, Brad Harris, Mark Forrest, Richard Harrison, and Gordon Mitchell. And he is presently survived by his wife. So that's the bio of Ed Fury. I liked him. He brought a unique approach to his characters. They were very expressive. He was very expressive. There was somewhat a satirical approach to some of his acting, which I found amusing. So, yeah, he was a great asset to the sword and sandal movement, if you will, in films. And I wanted to honor him tonight. But Ursus in the Valley of the Lions was probably my favorite in terms of the work he's done. And, in fact, tonight before bed, I'll probably watch it again.
Thank you for sharing it with us today and bringing back memories, and for also discussing the Olympian spirit as well as the Olympian approach to training. And you timed it perfectly. Our conversation's almost at an end. How can people get in contact with you, Michael? And do you have any last thoughts to leave at the end of your presentation?
Well, most of all is we do prayer work. You can write me for prayer, and I'll write you back. It's part of what we do at Michael Del Rossi, Box 129, Caldwell, New Jersey, 07006. We also have a holistic mind and a holistic health package. My Creative Health Manual covers everything you probably want to know about integrative health and natural therapies. And you can write me about that at the same post office box, 129 Caldwell, New Jersey, and I'll be glad to share with you.
Thank you again, and Michael will be back in 2 Mondays from now with our Herculean Physique show, and he's also going to be very much a part of our new UFO shows or our expanded UFO shows. So thank you very much, Michael. Have a wonderful evening, and I wish you all the best and great success with all your endeavors.
Thank you, my friend. Blessings to everyone.
Blessings to everyone. And now I'm going to continue with my review of Conqueror of Atlantis. Last we left off, Hercules was imprisoned as well as his companions by Queen Verna. Ramir frees them, explains the golden phantoms, and demonstrates the creation from the corpses of fallen desert warriors. He then reveals that he and his people are a colony of Atlanteans and explains that Verna is the latest and last living vehicle for the undying spirit of an ancient Atlantean queen. He also gives them a guided tour of their latest and greatest technology, including a mind control device, and explains how they work. The aging Queen Ming, now in her own body, summons them and outlines the Atlantean plan for world domination. Heracles and Kara are rendered unconscious and taken by Amazons, who seek to seduce them, only to be executed by the queen for knowing the love of a man, which is against the law in Atlantis, I guess. Our heroes are informed by Ramir that they are destined to become his lab rats, and they're imprisoned once again. Heracles knocks down a wall and rescues Verna. Kerr becomes a living robot in the service of Atlantis. Heracles frees them both from mind control and aids their escape. He then calls upon Olympus for assistance, confronts both Ramir and Queen Ming, then single-handedly takes on the Golden Phantoms. He does real well until he is struck down by an Amazon arrow and left for dead. Kerr and Verna reach their people and dedicate their combined forces to defeating Atlantis. The queen has meanwhile died and must be mourned. Heracles revives and returns to the laboratory to destroy the Atlanteans' power sources and environmental controls. Nomads fight the Golden Phantoms beyond the ruined city's walls. A maniacally laughing Ramir points a ray weapon at Heracles. Despite this, and being called a swine by Ramir, Heracles completes his task and Atlantis topples. A volcano, which was tapped as a power source and controlled by the Atlanteans and its alluvial technology, releases its fury and finishes the job. The Golden Phantoms fall and are granted the eternal rest long denied them. The nomads rejoice and head for home. Heracles and Verna, arm in arm, are among them and happy to be together at long last. And now, without further ado, our second host, Setna of Kemet, also known as Michael K. Waterman. Greetings, Michael. How are you?
I'm very well, and I want to wish everybody three things. First, happy full moon. Second,
thank you.
Blessed Lugnasa, or Lama's Tide, if you wish.
Thank you.
And third, for my people, the happy first day of the Egyptian New Year, the birth of Osiris. And one more personal note. This is the day I was initiated as a high priest, or raised to the level of a high priest in 1977. And so I'm kind of proud of that. That's a long time ago.
That is a long time ago. And I'm honored that you're here and being with us on such a wonderful celebratory day.
As you know, I sent on Facebook photos of my altar and my ritual. I gave blessings to all that needed it, and I can later, when we talk about information, tell you how to reach me for different ritual, ceremonial things and aids. Meanwhile, for Sword and Sandals, tonight I selected Cleopatra's daughter. In 1960, in the early 60s, in the late 50s, there was a craze because Elizabeth Taylor had taken the role of Cleopatra. Everybody and his cousin, including Marilyn Monroe, won that part. The Italians rushed to do knockoff movies, The Daughter of Cleopatra, The Son of Cleopatra, I'm waiting to hear, you know, The Dog of Cleopatra. There were all kinds of Cleopatra movies.
Yes,
this movie was made in 1960 in Italy. It stars Padgett, who you'd know from all kinds of movies. She was also Nefertiti, which is interesting, but she plays John Gerich, Love. He was Joshua in the Ten Commandments, and she's the one that was taken by Edward G. Robinson, who should never have been in that movie. Meow, meow. playing a fiend. Everybody and his cousin was in that movie. Vincent Price, even Margaret Hamilton has a bit part in one spot. But this movie takes place about 17 B.C.
Okay.
Cleopatra's daughter, Cleopatra Selene, is about 21, 22. She's on a caravan because she was raised by Augustus Caesar's sister. And she's on a caravan on some kind of a trip, and she's kidnapped. And she's made a slave. And she doesn't know she's Cleopatra's daughter. She just knows her name is Selene. Cleopatra Selene was her actual real name. And she's kidnapped by bandits, and she's dragged into slavery, and she's brought into this village. And you don't really know exactly where she is. It's actually in Libya. Numidia is Libya. And the truth, in reality, Augustus Caesar gave her to the king, Juba of Numidia. Now, what's also interesting about this movie, Deborah Padgett being, I would call her, the it girl of that time. She's very beautiful. You also would have seen her in The Mummy with Vincent Price and Christopher Lee. She did a lot of Pinewood Studios films, quite a few of them. And she's strikingly beautiful. And in this movie, she's particularly beautiful. But she's taken and she's a slave. A captain falls in love with her. And, of course, she's brought to the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh instantly decides that he's going to marry her. And she's not going to be a slave. The mother, Cleopatra, the Pharaoh's mother, knows that she's Cleopatra's daughter. And that's why she wants her to be the wife. The captain is played by Robert Alda, Alan Alda's father. I think this is one of the first movies he's in. He's probably maybe 25 or so, and he plays this beautiful, handsome, muscular, again, in the Hercules tradition, bodybuilding captain. He's got that physical Herculean attributes. He's very, very well built. All the men in this movie are incredibly, you know, muscular. So that keeps that theme of muscle men and, you know, bodybuilders going in, even into this film. So she's brought into the area. The mother goes, you know, you're not a slave. You're actually the daughter of the great Queen Cleopatra. And this girl doesn't believe a word of that. She's been raised for a long time as a slave, so she doesn't think she's a queen. But she has a mark, of course. There's always the mark of the royal male. Yes. There's some kind of birthmark somewhere. And they know she's got that mark. So they're going to make her the queen. So there are other factions that want to get rid of this king. And they're going to marry her off. And she becomes the queen of, what I guess, Libya and Egypt. And they poison him. So he's, of course, you know, that always happens. So the mother, of course, is going to have her killed because she's in bed with him. You don't see that. It's the 1960s. They didn't have, you know, the same bed. If you remember, Lucy and Ricky had separate beds.
Yes.
Nobody, a father knows best. All of those people had separate beds. So, you know, people didn't see things like that. And unlike Joan Collins in Land of the Pharaohs, Deborah Padgett's belly button was covered. A long sheath, beautiful sheath dress. I will say her makeup, the costumes, were historically accurate. She looked like a Ptolemaic or an Egyptian princess. So, you know, they're going to probably sacrifice her because the pharaoh, the king, has been killed, and the mother is going to accuse her, and therefore the mother would be put on the throne because, after all, you know, her son is dead. The girl is guilty, according to them. So what happens is that Robert Alda, I forgot the character's name, but Robert Alda rescues her, and she's, you know, there. Of course, there's all kinds of sword fights and spear fights and what have you, until finally he kills the evil grand. It's always the evil grand vizier. Have you ever noticed that, Hercules? In all these movies, it's a grand vizier.
But that's a comforting thing. The cliches, they're familiar. They're recognizable.
The evil minister, the evil wizard. He's always the sinister, you know, courtier that's going to, you know, have plans to do everything. Well, he wants to kill off the queen because, of course, he wants to be king. So that Robert Alda kills him. But I believe the queen also was poisoned. And, you know, instead of being queen of Egypt, queen of Cleopatra's daughter, he runs off into the sunset with her. Mm-hmm. So that what happens is that she now becomes his wife and they go off, you know, I guess on camels. I always laugh, and I want to tell you this. If you look at any temples or pyramids or any of the ruins in Egypt and any of the walls, you know what you're not going to see? Camels.
What?
Camels. There isn't one single camel on any of those walls, because it wasn't until the Arabs came and brought Islam to Egypt that they had camels. They weren't any.
I did not know that. I learned something new today. Thank you.
you'll see them on the cigarette packages back in the day, but there were no camels in Egypt until the Arabs brought them there, the Arab traders. And I always wondered about that when I was a kid. I was like, you know, but I'm laughing because in the land of the pharaohs, there's a scene where the pharaoh is running. They're having a war, and they're all on camels. And I was hysterical because there were no camels. They only had horses, oxen, you know, an occasional buffalo. Water buffalo. That's about it. There were no camels in that time. So that's kind of interesting. But so the dynamic of this movie is funny because it's not exactly historically accurate. I guess Spaghettiwood. Is that Italian Hollywood? Spaghettiwood?
All of that, yes.
Okay. It was a made-up story. I mean, this guy is the king of Libya and Egypt. As you probably know, Rome at the time was ruled almost all the world. So
yes.
Rome had power over, the Ptolemies were destroyed. There was a governor. After Cleopatra and Mark Antony were killed, Rufio, who was one of Octavian's soldiers, was left, and he became the governor of Egypt. The autocrat or Caesar, they called him. He was the governor. If you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York and you go to the Temple of Dendor, all you're going to see is autocrat or Caesar on the walls of that shrine, that temple, and all the gods and goddesses of Egypt bowing down to this Roman governor. It's not really an Egyptian temple. It's a Romanesque temple made by the sculptors of Egypt at the time. This is probably 21 or 22, again, B.C. And he's the governor, and they're honoring him. And you've got Isis, Osiris, all of them honoring this governor, bowing down to him. And that was Roman propaganda, of course.
Of course.
And the movie, in the way the movie was, too, because you've got this beautiful girl. She was a twin. Cleopatra had four kids. We actually had five. Nobody mentions the fifth daughter. She died. But she had four surviving children. Caesarion, that Octavian strangled. He said, as the kid was being killed, we cannot have too many Caesars. And that's why he strangled him. But there was Cleopatra Selene, her brother Alexander Helios, and then little Ptolemy Philadelphus. All three of those children were raised by his sister, Octavia, with Mark Antony's daughter Antonia. So that was kind of cool. And we don't know what happened to the boys. We know, I imagine they were killed. But we do know that she really did become the queen of Libya, and that about 35 or 40 years later, her granddaughter, Zenobia, came and knocked the crap out of the Romans, knocked them out of Libya and knocked them out of Egypt. They no longer, by the reign of, I guess it was Caligula, there was no Roman influence in Egypt anymore. They lost it. They had to pay tribute to this Zenobia to get grain and get anything else, grain, wheat, whatever Egypt had to offer, they had to get it from her. She destroyed the Roman power in Libya and in Egypt. It's something I only discovered recently.
That's two things I learned today. Thank you.
More and more I've learned about this Zenobia. She practiced Egyptian magic. She was, she was half Greco-Roman and half Libyan. So she was darker skinned. She probably had black hair. Her father was a Bedouin, so he was very dark skinned. And, you know, she didn't look anything like her grandmother or her mom. They say she was, you know, more African than she was Arab or Greek. And, you know, this is an interesting thing. But apparently very powerful warrior. As we know, Cleopatra herself was trained in the arts of war. I don't think Cleopatra Selene was. I think Cleopatra Selene knew which fork to use. she wasn't she was dainty. Her granddaughter was not, and her mother was not. So the movie ends. It's kind of a fun movie. It's filmed, and it shows you it's filmed in Technicolor, you know, so they were showing all those exaggerated colors, which was true of the whole Sword and Sandals, you know, epic. Everybody was in bright colors, and the lipsticks were bright, and everybody was, you know, a little more skin tone, a little brighter skin tone that was actually real. And, of course, all those Italian girls had beautiful eye makeup. As a makeup artist, I always looked at them. I thought they were gorgeous, beautiful things. I don't know what happened with Deborah Padgett, but I also know that she was also Pocahontas in a movie about Lewis and Clark. And she got around. She was a very, very, very much well-worked actress. And it's well worth watching her in this movie because she's very beautiful. And her acting isn't bad. She's rather good. Robert Alda is very interesting. Of course, he went on to have a much larger career. And, of course, his son was Hawkeye on MASH.
Yes, on MASH.
And they, you know, the family. And there's a third, his, I believe it was Alan Alda's brother, is in one of the episodes of Columbo. He plays an Italian boy whose uncle is killed. It's one about Louis Jourdan is in it. It's about poisoning the wine. I just saw that. I love Columbo. And it was an interesting thing. So I was very honored to be able to work today with you because of the fact that it was this sacred holiday to me and to all pagans. And also those of us who follow the Kemetic faith, this is very sacred. The next 4 days. Tomorrow is Horus.
Mm-hmm.
The third day will be Set, and you have Isis and then Nephthys. So those are the five. Now, this is a very interesting thing. So their New Year's was five New Year's Eves, five New Year's days. And the birth rate went up, of course. But this is a great time of great festival and celebration.
And new beginnings.
Now, too. I'm sorry, Hercules?
And new beginnings, which is always
new
a good
beginning.
Thing. Chance to start
it's
a new chapter in your life. And you were initiated on this day, too, so you started a new and more spiritual life as well.
This is why they had me initiated on this day, because it was a whole new, you know, I was given new robes, a different amulet that I wore, and on my finger I still wear a cobra ring, which I've had since I was a young man, a long, long time ago. But this is the symbol of my group, my grove, I guess you would say. This is long before I created Pernitaru, of which I am the founder, which is the temple I belong to and I'm part of now, which follows exclusively the Nitaru, the gods and goddesses, the pantheon of Egypt. And this is what I teach. But it was an honorable, a wonderful thing that happened with this ritual that night. I felt, I guess the word is a catharsis. India, it's called Shaktiput, or a stream of consciousness. I felt much more connected to the higher forces because of the ritual that we did that night. It was an amazing, I guess the word is epiphany, real shock. A stream of consciousness. I became much more connected with the higher forces. So for pagans, this day, Lugnasad, Lammastide, is the first harvest ritual. You'll see all the altars, and I just did a ritual with the Long Island. I'm going to give a plug to the Long Island Open Circle. And we had corn and fruit and other vegetables and things all along the altar, celebrating the harvest and celebrating, as you say, new beginnings, but also what we put into the universe already. This is getting back what you've already put out. And this is an amazing thing. And also we did Thanksgiving, and I've done all day prayers for people, including yourself, because I knew you were still ailing.
Thank you.
Prayers for people, for health, for finding homes. I have friends, a lot of friends, as we know, that are looking for housing, a permanent places to live, for prosperity, for food, all kinds of different written needs. So as a high priest, I led these rituals all day long. I have candles burning right now. My altar is glowing. I'm sitting right in front of my Osiris altar, which I will have up for some day. Tomorrow I will do for his son Horus, and then I will do for Set, and on so on and so on. And so that we have, you know, great energies for those things and great thanksgiving that these beings are here connecting with us and, you know, giving us much more energy and helping us in our daily lives.
And an opportunity came up, so I'll offer it to you. Monday I had a cancellation. So if you would like to do your ceremony on Zoom on Monday, that is something we could definitely arrange to do.
Oh, Hercules, I'd be more than honored to do that. Thank you. I would love to show people what we do and, you know, give people a little insight into the Kemetic ritual. I'd be most honored. Thank you.
Up in our consciousness, and it needed to be scheduled, and the schedule's kind of tight. And then today when I was checking with someone, they were unfortunately not returning from their vacation on time. So I'm going to link to some of their older shows, show reruns, but that leaves my recording time free. So we'll do it on Monday.
You can post my altar if you wish, or any other thing that you wish along with that, and we will talk about it from there. I'm very excited to do that. I want to show people exactly what I do. I'm very honored. It's exciting. I'm going to go back to the movie. They show rituals there, too. Priests with incense and shaking sistrum and chanting. Many different films like that have actual ceremonial things based on the walls and the temples. And that's what this has done. I didn't like the idea that they were going to sacrifice her or anybody else. It was known that early on, very early on, pre-dynastic period, they've uncovered tombs where the pharaoh or whoever, a high official, is buried. And around his body are non-mummies. People that have, you see, skeletal remains, people that weren't preserved, and it's believed they were either brought into the pit, the tomb, and sacrificed, or they willingly committed suicide so they'd be alongside the pharaoh. I don't know if you know this, but that was true in Ur, in the Sumerian traditions, that when the king died, all the elders of the court went with him.
Yeah, the household as well in many cases.
Yes, his queen, not the son, and the younger women of the harem did not go, but his favorites and his pets, high officials, they were all required to go into the tomb, and either be strangled or suffocated or poisoned, so that they would take with their lord into the next life. You know that that's also true in Viking traditions, and I think early Greek traditions too. When you had I was reading something about a king from Sparta that when he died, I think it was his wife, his generals, two of them, and slaves from the household that were brought, they found in his tomb. I don't want to call it a tomb, his burial chamber. Do you know of this?
I don't know of that particular instance, but I wouldn't doubt it. The Mediterranean was one big shared culture center. So things were happening one place, were happening everywhere else along the Mediterranean, the Black Seas. So I wouldn't doubt it.
I was sure that was probably true. You know, again, they found only skeletal remains. On this particular king, they found, I believe it was a beaten gold mask or brass or bronze.
They did try to take their stuff with them, you know, so there was none of it. You can't take it with you. They would take things with them, their people and their pets and their stuff, too. They were buried with a lot of their stuff and a lot of their treasures.
Everybody knows the Egyptians did, Lord knows. I mean, all you got to think of is King Tut's tomb. The only thing he didn't bring with him was a washer dryer, you know? He had all those ushabti which represented. By then, they were kind enough not to sacrifice the courtiers. They had their little statues called ushabti, and they also had images of people around him, so that the spirit statues held the energy rather than sacrificing people. You know, that was true also. My favorite tomb outside of Egypt is the first emperor's tomb in China, where they have all those hundreds and hundreds of soldiers and courtiers and horses and chariots. And, oh, my God, so much. And do you know about the tomb of Ra in Egypt? He's in the Metropolitan Museum, including he's there, too. They took the whole tomb with them. But there are miniature granaries and breweries and slaughterhouses and bakeries and all kinds of little things so that he would be, you know, I guess it took a village to bury him.
Uh-huh.
So they have a whole village there. My favorite statue in all the world, everybody thinks of all the grand, colossal things, but all my life there was one statue in the Metropolitan Museum. She's a beautiful young lady, and she has a crate of basically chopped meat parts, and she's carrying two ducks, and she's a servant, and she was gone into Ra's tomb. There are a few others from that tomb that are in other museums, but she's such a beautiful statue, and you can tell she can't wait to give her things, her services and her goods to the high priest Ra. And she's just such a beautiful statue. And it's nothing famous. It's nothing grand. She's not a goddess. She's not a queen or a king. She's just this beautiful servant girl. But I was touched by it when I was a child because of the sereneness of her. And the you could see the look in her eye is, I can't wait to help you. So that was a beautiful thing. And I've seen that in other statues, but not like her. If we ever get to the Metropolitan Museum together, I would love to show her to you.
Well, that would be great. We met in New York City last time, in downtown New York City, so maybe we could arrange a get-together with the gang down there, and we could all visit the museum together. That would be great.
Because I love, you know, Cleopatra's needle is out, which has got nothing to do with her, by the way. It's for the pharaoh Tutmosis. But it's a long story, and I don't want to get into that now. We don't have time. But the museum has... from every dynasty, from Djoser or pre-dynastic all the way to the Ptolemies. And there are a whole room of mummies, which is kind of a little icky. You know, you can feel their energy. They're kind of annoyed that they're there. But you can feel, it's like, you know, why am I in this icebox? Why aren't I in some hot tomb somewhere? So anyway, I really enjoyed this movie. I do recommend it to everyone. It is... it's not historically accurate, but it's a cute story. It's got romance. It's got a little violence. It's got something for everybody. It's got gorgeous costumes. It's got beautiful scenes. So, and I think you'll all love it very much.
I remember it vaguely, but you made me recall a lot of details as you were describing it. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. There's also like the son of Cleopatra and the son of Samson. There's all sorts of son and daughter movies or the characters appear in movies. So thank you very much for sharing that with me and with everybody. And now we're at the point in today's conversation where you share your contact information and your activities.
Okay, well, I did just finish this ritual. I will be planning now for the autumn equinox. I will probably do a public ritual then too. I am going to, you can reach me at Michael K. Waterman at Facebook.com, of course. You can get me at MK Waterman at iCloud.com. You can get me through Hercules, of course. You can also get me on one of my other pages, which is Phono Wizard. And then I have Michael Waterman Arts and Crafts. The Art of Michael Waterman, which is also, all of these are on Facebook, and you'll find them. The way you'll know that it's me on Facebook is that one of them is myself behind huge butterfly wings This is a photograph that was made by my late husband, and it's very dear to me, so I keep it on my Facebook page. You can get me at mkwaterman at icloud.com. On my phone, you can get me at 516-650-3691. I don't do the address because it's better, but, you know, also all of my services for Phono Wizard, my metaphysical, my artwork, all of that will be available to you from Phono Wizard if you wish.
Thank you so very much. Are there any last thoughts you'd like to leave with anybody about anything, about Lunasa, about Egypt, about the movie?
I just want to thank you. You've given me such wonderful opportunities and, you know, a platform by which I can be open to the world. And I want to say this to everybody. Hercules has changed my life. I'm so emotional now. When my husband died, things were pretty sad. And all of a sudden, this man came into my life. My hero as a child, my superstar hero, Hercules. In my case, Steve Reeves. And then all of a sudden, here it is. The real Hercules is in my life. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for changing my life.
You're very welcome. Glad to be of the service. And I'm very glad that our paths are crossed. And I'm greatly enjoying our adventures together and look forward to even greater glories ahead.
Thank you. I agree. I can't wait. One day we'll get on a barge together. We'll go hippopotamus hunting. It'll be wonderful.
There you go. Things to look forward to in the Temple of Dendar before then in Cleopatra's Needle. And thank you
Absolutely.
So very much, Setna, and thank you to all our wonderful guests and our wonderful audience. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and you're waiting in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand, until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thanks again, Setna.
Thank you. Blessings all.
Blessings all.